This week we've talked some earlier about the early days before agriculture evolved. And in the first session we were talking about the Golden Age. That's the time when you go way, way back and come up to about 10,000 BCE or before the Common Era, at which time agriculture began to emerge. And so last time we were talking about that, the emergence of agriculture, the domestication of the crops, or plants and animals, and kind of a quick sweep up to where we were at presently. Now tonight, what we want to talk about in this session is some of the what I call contemporary problems or issues. There are a lot of questions raised about agriculture as it's presently being practiced, and I think that agriculture is getting a little bit of a bad rap myself. So, but I don't want to be defensive about this, and so therefore what I've done is lined up some slides and so forth that I've used sometimes before that give some figures, and there are some real problems to be sure, but I think there's also great opportunity for optimism. I talked about two books before. There is a book in the bookstore if you're interested in this topic at all. There's another edition of this book in the bookstore. It'd be the third edition, Seed to Civilization, The Story of Food. It has a prettier cover on it than this one does. This is the issue before it, or the printing edition before it. And another book that is not available over there that I have referred to is called Crops and Man. This is written by he's a geneticist and has worked his whole life with the various plants and where they originated and how they've been changed over time and how they're presently used. It's Professor Jack Harlan, University of Illinois. There is another book over there, and I don't know if they have more than one copy. This is Tending the Garden, Essays on the Gospel and the Earth. This is a series of, as I recall, about 10 or 12 essays that get into sort of where do we go from here, whose responsibility is it to help heal the earth from some of these things that have been done. And I believe tomorrow in the session, before we get, I have another session tomorrow morning, I'll be commenting some on that. Now there is one other book that is available in the bookstore. I think I saw it over there, and I did not read it, but I have listened to the whole audio set. In fact, I brought them with me, and I've just completed that. And I think it's a pretty good book. And that's by our now Vice President, Albert Gore. And the title of that book, if you haven't heard it, it's called Earth in the Balance, Ecology and the Human Spirit. And it's written by, he wrote it when he was a senator, and it was published in 1992. And so I'll perhaps comment some about that as we go along. It is a good book. I think one place in there, it's obvious the election had not been held yet. And he was getting pretty hard on the Republican Party. Can't recall where it was, but he was. I noticed when I was listening to the tape that I wrote in my notes that Gore spends too much time on this, and he was kind of getting after George Bush because some things about birth control issues and so forth on population. Other than that, it's not a political book. It's a pretty straightforward presentation. I thought it was pretty good. What I'd like to do is just kind of sit here and project up. We don't have to turn lights on. Would you push up above? There's that one switch that goes forward. You see it?
Power?
Yeah, push that all the way forward. Okay? And I think we'll be in business. And what I have here is slides, and we can stop and look at them and talk about them as we go. And if you have any questions or any comments, speak up, because this is such a tremendously big subject that there is no way we can begin to cover it all. And so if you have any ideas or questions or comments, let's have them whenever you feel like it. Doesn't bother me a bit. Now, I started out the week by saying that I didn't feel qualified to talk about the social aspects of humankind and food as much, or political even, as I do feel a little bit more confident about speaking about the physical and the biological resources. And by that, we mean land, water, air, and so on and so forth, because that's my background. Now, when you look at these physical and biological resources in conjunction with food, there are many issues. Agricultural production, water resources, forests, atmosphere and climate, the genetic resources of plant and animal, nuclear energy. And there was a report that came out, it's maybe 10 years old now or so now, it's called the Global 2000 Report. In fact, it's older than that now, but it was a very extensive report that dealt with all these types of issues. What I'd like to do is just go through a couple of these, or talk about a couple of these, mostly that have to do, of course, with agricultural production, with land as a resource, a little bit about water, and so forth as we go through this. First of all, it might be good to take a look at, you know, when we sit down and have a meal like we just completed, where does that meal fit, you might say, in this picture? This is basically where the energy in our food comes from, when you take it in the aggregate, and it all adds up to 100%. Grain, that is wheat, and that makes our bread and so forth, that, yes?
Is this U.S.?
No, this is world. This is world based. That's right. Yeah, 55%. Beans, peas, lentils, soybeans, about 13%. Meat, milk, eggs, fish, fats, and oils, 18%. Other things, potatoes, fruits, vegetables, cassava, and so forth, about 14%. So you see the big one. In fact, if we want to click off the big ones, they're rice, wheat, corn, maize or corn will cover, and potatoes will cover a tremendous amount of what's feeding the world. You got to have rice in there. It's the biggest. It's almost, I believe it's the biggest. Wheat is maybe runs a close second.
How about millet?
Oh, millet's big. Grain, millet for food too. Right. You go on down the list. And then of course you come in on the animal side, cattle and pigs and so forth, and chickens. So grain is one of the big ones, and so we have to be thinking about that. Now what I'd like to do is think about, this is not Holden language when we say food for man, it maybe should be food for humankind. But you basically start with land and water. And we need the air so we can have photosynthesis going on. In other words, we need, in the presence of sunshine, chlorophyll, the green matter in plants, we build carbohydrates in the plants. And that's our vegetation, and then that can either be shunted directly to humans, or it can go through animals. And we hopefully this would be just a nicely functioning ecosystem that just works real well. But it's so huge on a macro scale. It's different in different countries. But this is the basic flow of the resources that we follow. Okay, now land use. I left some spaces in there because I thought I might add some slides later, and I always get tired when you add a slide later of always moving the others. Okay, now it happens that in the United States we really are blessed with look at here, cropland. If we, 21, this is in percentages, So 21% of our land in the United States is cropland. In other words, we can grow crops on it. You take a picture of the Midwest, California, and the valleys, and all over. That's not necessarily true in other countries. In fact, if you take the other parts of the world, it's only 11% of total land on the world basis is cropland. So we're lucky in the United States. We're lucky in that regard. Grassland, pasture, and range, well, we're pretty much like the rest of the world on that. Forest land, again, you see we're quite similar to what the rest of the world, other land, and this is really unusable land, you might say. The mountains are so big you can't use them to crop or to grow trees on or anything. Just other. And we don't have them. So we have, in the U.S., you see, we've got this that can be worked with as far as food production goes. Not so much forest land, but certainly these can be. Now this is totals in millions of hectares, and that doesn't mean much to us, but you see, we've got about 1/18th of all the land surface. U.S. has about 1/18, which is or 5% of all the land. We've got 13% of the cropland. So, you know, we're lucky. We're lucky, and yes?
Are we concerned about the amount of cropland that we're losing to things being built on it?
You bet. You bet. And I think I've got some in here that state that specifically. You bet we are. And as we go through this will come up. What this breakdown should be as we move forward is a big question. Now, just offhand, I think that my thought is, and a lot of others, that we should be putting more into forest land, and some of this land that's in cropland ought to be coming up here and going into pasture and range. We should not be trying to come up with necessarily more cropland, because we've pushed it pretty far already. And that's one of the questions that could come up. You see, our population is stabilized in this country, so it's a matter, we can produce in this country all the food we need for the people in this country if it was adequately distributed and everybody got their share, so to speak. We have plenty of cropland to do that. In fact, the government programs are such that cropland is taken out. But then if you're thinking about free trade or helping to feed other people around the world, well, then it's another question. Now, another way to look at this is another one of the slides I had, was you can look at some of the other places. If you look at what the mix is, arable land would be land you can cultivate. Okay? Present arable land. Arable land potential, in other words, would be land that you could put into production. Pasture land, present permanent pasture potential. Let's take a look. Okay, North America, and this is North America, and I'll include Canada and Mexico. And so you see, if you look here, this one says that we have some more potential cropland. And there is more potential pasture land. South America, according to this analysis, there's a lot of potential cropland in there, or arable land. USSR, for example, you can go down through here. Oceania is always a tough one. That's Australia, New Zealand, and now Southeast Asia. And you can see that the potentials aren't so great. Look at Japan. It doesn't have a lot of land in terms of millions of hectares. A hectare is about 2.5 acres. So you see they don't have a lot. And In my work, I've been to Japan and Korea several times having to do with pasture land. People say, you went to Japan and they don't grow any pasture, do they? I thought the whole country was just rice. And I said, not so. You go up in Hokkaido, North Island of Japan, and you'd think you were right there in central Wisconsin or Minnesota, because the Holstein cows and the barns and silos and, you know, Japanese came over here years ago and took a look at stuff and they adapted a lot of those, and so they have hilly land that they put in pasture on, and they're in dairy production. Of course, they have all the rice production elsewhere. So this gives you some shape, but according to this is maybe a little bit optimistic, because you see that it's painting in each of these cases that there's more potential
In fact, it's this particular one, Africa, it says that there's not much potential to increase all that land that's used where the cattle and livestock run. So it's another way of looking at it. And who the person that defines the potential, it could vary. Somebody might, one group might be much more conservative, another group, yes.
Do you know about when that...
No, this is, when this was done?
20 years ago? Or?
Yeah, it's about 20. It'll be about 20 now.
Because it would have probably changed a lot from that.
Yeah, it's just one of the slides I had, and I thought, well, it's maybe one that will illustrate... okay, and I showed this slide the other day, and this I put it in again, because if you take this section here, which is, in this description, called 3, this is one of the most productive agricultural ones across the whole world. And if, in other words, you take the agricultural productivity of Denmark and Lower Sweden and Great Britain and France and all these countries, and right across, and add to it then the upper, here's Hokkaido, and then the north central United States, tremendous amount of production. This one is maybe not quite as productive, totally glowing, and this one has a lot of difficult problems because it's hot, dry, and even though they have a so-called full growing season, you know, they don't have winter like we have in Minnesota, they have hot and dry, and it's just so that you just can't produce crops there. You can't grow 2 or 3 crops a year unless you have water to go with it, and a lot of times you don't have that. Okay, now then, if you take a look at this land, that's the first one I want to take. This is a shot I took up in northern Minnesota. You were saying you were from McGregor. I can't remember where I took this, but I think it's up north and west of Duluth someplace, but this is a place where they have a fence around here, and they were using this for pasture. But that's really not very good land. For those of you that aren't acquainted necessarily with agriculture, that's very marginal. But you see, the settlers themselves, I mean, that was it. You went out there and you pushed the rocks away and you tried to hack out a living. But that really should be back, in my opinion, should be back in timber, you know, it should be back in forest. Because the productivity of that, no matter how you raise it, isn't very high.
Eventually it will be back in timber, because all of the, what used to be dairy farms are going back into brush and popple.
Right. Are you going to be here tomorrow?
Yeah.
If you're here in the morning, I've got slides about the dairy industry and how that's changed, because I'm going to talk about alternative agriculture and how the bigness, and now what are we going to do? You're right. This is what's going to happen.
When I was a kid, there was families every quarter to half a mile, there was a small farm. If you had 10 or 15 cows, you had plenty. Today, if you don't have 80 to 100 cows, you can't make it.
Yeah, this economy of size is really something. But alternative agriculture, or the new alternative agriculture movement, is addressing some of those possibilities of, you know, the dairy industry is going to be difficult to shift back, but some of the other ones can maybe do it. Okay, now then, let's take another land. Okay, here's a shot I took some years ago, and this is down in Iowa. And look at, this is wind erosion. Excellent land, but the wind, of course, this was open. It wasn't protected. Maybe it had been a cornfield or something. Looks like there's kind of remnants of corn stubble rose here or something. But it just, in other words, a winter of blowing and not being covered. You got a whole ditch full of silt. And I've got some figures later on to deal with this, to talk about the erosion figures in the United States. And the real alarmists use the top figure of how much is eroding. And it's not good. The very conservative people say that's overblown. I mean, that's not supposed to be a pun, but it's the figure is higher than it should be because you're just moving it around. See? So here, what they do, they move it from there to the ditch. And then, of course, the county and somebody has to come by and clean out the ditch, and you get some of that silt back on the fields again, which is an expense. But hopefully they don't get a big storm that moves it down into the rivers. Yes?
In North Dakota, there's no fences there, so the farmers go down the ditches with their scrapers and they put it back.
Is that right?
But of course, that doesn't save the stuff that blows miles away.
Right, right. And of course, wind erosion in the dust bowls of the 30s, it's really interesting. In the 1930s, when we had the dust bowl, then the actual dust and silt in the air was up in the sky so much that it had clouds of dust and silt over New York City and Washington, D.C. in 1934 and 35. Can you imagine that? In other words, it's just picking it up and carrying it. So it... Okay, now this one doesn't show up so much here with the lights, but this is the snowbank in Iowa in the middle of winter. You can see this road that's going through here, and they push the snow up, and it's just full. It's full of silt that's come off the fields. And you get the snow off the road, and then in the spring, as it melts down, of course, there you see the silt. So that's evidence of winter. Here's another one, winter erosion. I took out just outside of Ames, Iowa, and because I was so disturbed. There's an open field back here. Well, here's a cornfield. That's pretty well tied down. It's holding the snow, the corn stalks. Then there's an open field, and from that, it's going across and depositing itself in the ditch here. Okay? Now, this is a shot in western Iowa. I just want to give you some idea what we deal with when you talk about soil and soil erosion. This is western Iowa, and east of Omaha, 50, 60 miles. And a little bit north. And when I worked with Iowa State University, we have an experimental farm out there. And so I was going out there many times a year for almost 30 years. And it's fascinating to me because I didn't grow up in that kind of country. This is land that in geological times, it picked up the silt coming across the Missouri River and blew this up into ridges. So that these are hills of windblown silt in western Iowa. And it's called Loess, L-O-E-S-S. It's a German term for windblown silt. And so when you cut the road through there, from top to bottom, this soil is exactly the same. And so just imagine, there isn't a topsoil and bottom soil, basically. It's just silt. And it's quite good for farming. But it's very erodible. It's very erodible. And they like to grow corn. This farmer, you see the corn rows here. He's already put in the corn in the spring of the year. But it's a fascinating place. In the Palouse country of eastern Washington, where they grow the wheat, it's the same basic soil, as I understand it. Palouse, it's windblown silt. And those, you know, you've seen the pictures of the wheat farmers in eastern Washington. Very subject to erosion. Okay, just another shot. You begin to see in this type of a situation there in western Iowa, you can see that I think the farmer's been tilling a little bit here, but you can see that the darker color, the organic matter of the soil, it's been moved. Over here you can see the top of the ridge is lighter, and on the sides it hasn't eroded as much. So even that type of a situation, you'd have soil erosion. Now, I have four slides here that are really interesting to me, because and I can check the dates when I took these pictures. Somehow or another, this field always bothered me. It's about 3-4 miles east of the experimental farm. In spite of all the things that the Soil Conservation Service and other people, the county agents, the Ag College, and you name it, this particular field, they just wanted to grow corn on there. And I took this, I just checked this today. This is in about June of 1962. And I stopped the car, I gotta get a picture of it. Here he's planting his corn. You see the corn is up this high. It may or may not make it by the 4th of July to be knee high, or, you know, this is kind of a... And look at here, he's got erosion, it had rains down here. That really shouldn't be in corn. It was kind of a sort of field like this. But he has kept out some small areas here that, okay, that was 1962, as I recall. I took that slide. This one jumps up to about 1971. Every year he planted corn on this field. Okay, what they did up here at the top, they put a bench terrace around the top. So up on top, it kind of stops. But he still wanted to grow corn in this dish. The road comes right down here. See? And now he's up to using a 1, 2, 3, 4, about a 6 or 7 or 8 or 8-row planter or 12-row, whatever it is, he can get that in a hurry, get out of there, but he wants to grow corn. Okay? Every year. There's one year I got it in July or August. Doesn't look too bad when the corn is on the field. You wouldn't know that that's a badly eroded field. But that's the same field. See, it's handed out, passed it out, so I don't know, it's in August sometime. You'd say, well, isn't that beautiful? But, and I think I got one more. That's that same field in late 70s, early 80s. Grown corn on top, and he had the corn that I think had just dried up on him. It almost looks like he went out of corn and tried to put something else in there.
Will the bushels per acre on that be considerably less?
Oh yeah, just down. But my point is that, I guess the point is that here's a case that where you have all the information available, all the technology, freedom of choice, et cetera, and it doesn't happen. So stewardship of the land, conservation of our natural resources, my gosh, you just gotta, you know, you kind of like hitting a donkey over the head with a 2x4. You gotta get their attention before you get anything happen. And so when these fellows came into my class at Iowa State University and, you know, they're studying to be agronomists or whatever, you just gotta pat them over the head and say, hey, this is what's going on. You know, I mean, if your dad did it, you can't do it that way anymore.
Is that silt or clay?
Yeah, this is that silt. This is that silt, same windblown silt, right. That's one illustration. Okay, so what's happened? This is a bad case scenario. A lot of the prime land in the United States has gone to intensive cropping. And this slide is maybe 10 years old. About 125 million acres have gone to cropland. That's for intensive cropping, like corn production. And most of it came out of pasture and rangeland. And the minute you put it in the intensive cropping, they're subject to more erosion. So how about that soil erosion? Well, this is a statement in 1975. 50% of 335 million acres of harvested cropland in 1975 was subject to moderate, severe, or very severe erosion. Okay? Now what's severe erosion? The U.S. Soil Conservation Service says they will accept, if you have a 5-ton per acre soil loss off your field, it's acceptable.
Every year?
Yeah. No, and then that's, right. Some people say, well, why should there be any loss at all? Why do you have any loss? And then you could say that. Well, they know that's an impossible thing to not have some loss. So they say 5 tons per acre. You can calculate that out. And that's higher than we'd like to see, obviously, but they will accept
that. 1, 2, 3 inches? How much is that?
No. I'm just going to try to go through that if I can remember. An acre, a 6-inch layer of soil is 2 million pounds. So 5 tons is 10,000 pounds, and I can't remember figure that out. It's not an inch.
It's not an inch.
No. But if you let this happen, and I used to have this right at the tip of my tongue, if you let that happen too many years in a row, you could lose an inch of soil. How long does it take to get another inch of soil from basic geology? Well, it takes maybe 100 years, 200 years if you're lucky. So in other words, if they say 5-ton per acre is acceptable, they actually calculated out these estimates that it was happening at 9 tons per acre. So it's way more than acceptable. In some places, running 14, 15 tons per acre. On some land in the southeastern United States where it's quite rolling in the Piedmont, it's too high. Palouse region, I don't know where they grow the wheat. So this is what was going on. And I haven't seen the figures lately, but this is a concern. This is a concern, soil erosion. In other words, the interesting thing is if you go to an agricultural economist, you say, well, how much is this worth? Can you put a cost on that? And I did that many times to talk to this guy. I said, pretty. As you see what I mean? If you do it that way, the soil's worth nothing. You just buy a little more fertilizer. The problem with that is, in some of the areas I grew up in Wisconsin, is when your topsoil's gone, all you got left is the subsoil, and then you don't have much. So I'm just bringing this up to you, that this is these calculations and so forth. Now, one of the places in the world where tremendous soil erosion in the last 15, 20 years is in Brazil. They want to be big in soybeans. They are big in soybeans. They're competing on the world market. I haven't been there myself, but they said it's just horrible.
But they're taking down all the rainforest.
Yeah, and I think some of that land, right. But they had land that maybe didn't have to be. If you take down a rainforest and end up putting it in there and then grow soybeans and have all this erosion, you see how it can be very destructive. And then here we go, the figure before, the shift of usable land to other uses. Here you got the figure. They said that 3 million acres a year that's going into parking lots and shopping centers and developments. So you could say, man, you know, every little town, every little burg, you know, yeah, to say, I just heard the other day that Walmart's big in the Midwest, you know. And there's a professor of agricultural economics at Iowa State University he calculated this out. He said, hey, this Walmart coming in your town, is that going to be positive or negative? And right away they say, well, we're going to add so many jobs, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and so on and so forth. He said, yes, but look, boom, 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 and take some of your land, and so on and so forth. So, and of course, they got some other economists to kind of go head-to-head with him and tell him all the good things. So Walmart's continuing to be built, okay? In Carroll, Iowa, in western Iowa, and I heard this in the report, they said, if you want to build Walmart in this town, you're going to have to build it within our so-called city walls. In other words, this is our city. You aren't going to go out there on the outskirts and on this good land and build it. Why can't you put it downtown? Downtown Carroll, Iowa isn't real big, but it's, you know. And that's what they did. I haven't seen it, but I used to go to Carroll, Iowa through Iowa. And so that's, in other words, it can be done. They didn't use any more land. They still have their Walmart. But that's a striking figure when you think about it. Okay, now if you think of land loss and abuse around the world on a world basis, you got soil erosion, nutrient loss, soil compaction is a big one, salinization, which happens under irrigation. The salts come up to the surface and can be problems, and desertification follows. In other words, if you read some of the older books, you know, these areas, some of them are deserts now, were once good farmland. And Tigris, Euphrates River Valley, Mesopotamia, and those areas in biblical times, they aren't very productive now. So there are a lot of lessons to be learned from history on that score. Now, another thing that's talked about in the Global 2000 report is the plant and animal genetic resources. And I'm just quoting from their book. They say that we have 10 million species on Earth, estimated. And at that time, on this Global 2000 report, that's only 7 years away, they were predicting that we could lose 15 to 20% of all those species by the year 2000. Scary, isn't it? And that's these rainforests that you talk about. And however, again, let's say that there are always two sides to the issue. I haven't gotten a hold of this book, but there's a book out by two people in the United States that they are definitely claim they have information to show that these figures, they're too exaggerated. And some people say, well, yeah, what if we only lost 1.5 to 2%? Isn't that something to be concerned about? That's true. But, you see, some of these figures get carried on, and those, how does it happen? Clearing and degradation of the tropical forests, water quality in the freshwater ecosystems, and food and feed grain diverse germplasm. This one is important. Harlan, in his book, points out that what we have now in our total, let's say, wheat production in this country and around the world, as a matter of fact, wheat and corn, some of these major crops and rice, that the components of some of our highest yielding rice varieties, highest yielding wheat varieties, all have a common parent in their background. And what you're really scared what plant breeders are really afraid of, you see, is if you had some disease that attacks, let's say, rice, that we don't perceive of. And with a common parentage in a lot of the rices or a lot of the wheats, I mean, you know, a lot of this food that we think just flows, the weeds, the wheat flour, could be threatened. And when you have a person as wise as this man who wrote the book, and he's talking about that, you know, it's something to be concerned about. Now, what, you maybe don't understand, but you see, it was a much broader germplasm base before, when you had every little farm. And every country had what they call land races of these various crops. If you go to Scandinavia, the Norwegian land race of a certain crop maybe was different, the red clover, than it was in Sweden. So it wasn't exactly the same. And that may be different from the one in Germany that developed in their situation. And then now with these bigger systems, we have, and we had a scare in the United States in the 1970s here. It was called the Southern Corn Leaf Blight. I believe it was 1974, and it took a lot of the corn crop out, because a lot of the corn hybrids all had a common parentage. And when they became susceptible to a certain disease, you know. So that's something I'm very concerned about, is the genetic diversity that you have in the feed grains and food grains.
Yeah, if you got something like the phylloxera that's going through the California vineyards right now, going through a basic food crop.
Yeah.
It just destroying them.
That's, see, what is that again?
It's phylloxera. It's a root louse.
A
louse. It's just,
yeah.
It basically sucks the plants dry, you know, so that they just stop producing and they have to pull out the whole vineyard and start again. Mm-hmm. Well, they have nothing that protects against it.
Yep.
Once they've got it, they just have to pull them out. But something like that got into a basic food crop and did the same thing.
Yep. And as you think of the future, and this is just something just to think about, is that if this control that to stop this has to be chemically oriented, or pesticide or herbicide, then it means a lot of chemicals that a lot of people don't like to see. Of course, they have to be non-residue, so they don't get into the water. So the approach is a biological approach. To, in other words, if you got some kind of a fruit fly or something, if you got another one, it'll take that one out. But then you see, man, this is a little scary, because it's sort of humans thinking we can figure out this ecosystem. See, we got it figured out. All we got to do, and there's some classic experiences. I wish I had that slide with me, because I traveled in Australia and New Zealand a couple of times. A classic experience of going awry was in the fellow that settled outside of Adelaide in Australia, and he, an Englishman, and he wanted to have rabbits in his, he wanted, you know, he had a kind of English country estate type of place where he lived. He thought, all I need is some rabbits, you know, to make this really like old, jolly old England. And so he brought rabbits in there, and they just multiplied by the jillions. And they just couldn't stop them. And I've got a picture that's taken out of an Australian textbook. It just shows it shows an Australian water hole out in the country. It just, you know, it must be 1,000 rabbits trying to get water. They just ate up all the vegetation. In other words, the rabbit didn't fit their ecosystem.
And what did they do about it?
Oh, they shot them and killed them, and, you know, this and that, and built fences and all kinds of stuff. But now they have, something that's anaplasmosis.
It's a toxoplasmosis, I think it was.
Yeah.
It was a rabbit disease that wiped out a lot of the Australian rabbits, and then they came over to Europe and wiped out a lot of the European rabbits.
Yep. So I guess I'll just bring that one up, because when you start the biological, this, and we'll talk more about that tomorrow. When you start talking alternative agriculture and you say we're going to get rid of all those chemicals, you know, and we're going to do it some other way, that has to be quite carefully done, because you don't know what can happen in some regard. Okay, water. Man, water is important. I'll tell you, Senator Gore, in this book I read, and the notes I took from listening to his tapes, I mean, he talks about in the 14 different civilizations that depend upon the river Nile for their water, and as those populations go up, there's no more water. There is no more water. It's the same amount of water that this tremendous population has to use. And the big issue, one of the big issues in the United States today is the water quality. We maybe don't see quality under so much, but the big buzzword in Washington is water quality in agriculture. Now, water quality. And that's something to be concerned about. Okay, this is predicted in this global 2000 report. 200 to 300% increase in the world water withdrawals from 75 to 2000. Well, gee, we're getting close to 2000, aren't we? So a lot more water is being used. Irrigation accounted for 70% of human uses in 67, expected to double by 2000. Much of the increased demand for water is in the least developed countries of Africa, South Asia, Middle East, and Latin America. Water supplies destabilized as forests are lost. And that's known. I mean, you take the forests away and the water goes down. That's what's happened in Nepal and places like that. Industrialization demand is increasing. So water is really critical. No question about it.
Do you realize that they're getting farm chemicals out of wells 800 and 900 feet deep down in Kansas and Nebraska?
I believe it. There's one. Now this is being monitored very closely. That's a good point. But I think it's always good to raise to. I think this is. How should I say it? That the detection levels that you have nowadays on what's in the water. In other words, you can pick up a part per billion of DDT or whatever, which is much more precise than it used to be. So that's one thing. But it's still down there, and you can say, well, how did it get down there? You know?
But they're getting so bad that they're even fining some of the farmers for contaminating city wells.
That's right.
Because of the farm chemicals.
That's right. No, yes, Paul.
Well, don't you think though that part of the solution to this is population control?
Yep.
But when you start talking that, you've got a political, you know, it's just people get fanatic and all upset, you know, if you start suggesting we should limit the family sizes and things like that. That's a real social problem.
Yeah.
I don't know how we're going to get around that.
Well. This might be a good time to just tell you what in this Senator Gore's, Vice President Gore's book, what he talks about on the tapes, and I think the book's the same way. He talks about some of the same stuff I've been talking about, you know, things are bad. In fact, he calls it up front, and I put this in quotes, he calls ungodly crisis that we have, you know. Rapidly deteriorating global environment.
Wasn't some of that shown to be suspect during the campaign that it was politically motivated as opposed to a careful assessment of the environment?
Oh yeah, I think it's all over. So I'm not necessarily.
Yeah.
I have listened to all the tapes, and I think he has maybe got some of the facts that make it look real bad. But even granting him that, there's still concern.
Yeah, by and large, it's creditable.
Well, I think so. I've heard some people say that it's not creditable, but I mean, I'm not so sure so I'm not prepared to say.
Yeah.
One of our sons is an ecologist, I think he's got a good head on his shoulders, and he bought the book, and he said, you ought to listen to that, Dad, and he gave me the tapes, and so I listened to it. Now, here's what Vice President Gore said. To make a long story short, what we've got to do, this is maybe where we're headed. In other words, it's going to give it some visibility now. Maybe something like this can begin to happen. He said that in the military, if you approach problems from the military, they usually divide them up into local types of problems, regional or strategic. And he said this is, he'd classify, if the little town of Carroll, Iowa is trying to decide whether Walmart should come into town or not, that's a local problem. They can decide that. You know, they don't want to take more farmland. And then there are others, a regional problem. Maybe this watershed, this Railroad Creek that comes down here. What happens up in Railroad Creek? The Forest Service is going to tell us when you should take out trees or whatever. That's a watershed problem. That's a regional. or maybe bigger. Now, when you get into a global deal, he said that's got to be strategic. Now, what he says is what we're going to need is a global, something that's a, like a global Marshall Plan, like we had after World War II, the Marshall Plan. Okay? And what he's calling that, I don't know, anybody read this book? Well, I feel okay about telling you that. He said that, well, you know, and this is one good thing he said about the Republicans, was he said that this thing that President Reagan had come up with was the SDI's Strategic Defense Initiative, but at least everybody pulled together and they got something done. So he said what we've got to have is a Strategic Environmental Initiative, SEI. And there are five strategic goals that have to be, that we have to work for as we go into the future. Now I can't quibble with these. The first one is population. Stabilize world population. Okay? Now when you talk about...
Meant to say that, some people are, you know, they think you're in favor of abortion and birth control.
That's right.
There's a certain section of people that just will not go along with either one of those.
I know, Paul, and that's where he got on Bush administration, because he was saying that, you know, this is surprising, all the good things that President Bush was for, but he sure wasn't up to speed on that one. And so stabilize world population. And we don't get time to talk about it here, but you see the predicted increase in the population of the world isn't going to be happening in the United States. 90% of this gigantic increase is going to be happening in the countries where there's also food shortages. But, so on a global initiative, stabilize these world population, we need low birth rates and death rates. And he does spend quite a bit of time, I don't have time to go into that here, in the book. And the second one was rapid creation and development of appropriate technologies, energy and agriculture. In other words, some the technology which is appropriate, and this was a term that came up 25 years ago, E.F. Schumacher of England, who wrote Small is Beautiful. I don't know if you've read that book, but it's a really good book. Small is Beautiful, and he said that, you know, this eight-row corn planter that this guy in Western Iowa uses, you certainly maybe just don't take that over there and tell a guy that wants to grow corn that this is what you use. I mean, it's got to be appropriate. Just here's a corn planter, but this is a small one. You see what I mean? It has to be appropriate. So that's what Vice President Gore says. We need to rapidly create and develop appropriate technologies for all these situations. Well, just think of the tremendous jobs. Just think of the great opportunities for young men that want to become agronomists. You know, to go to other parts of the world to show them how to grow crops and to use fertilizer correctly so that it doesn't go into the groundwater. So you can grow your own food. I mean, there are tremendous opportunities. Then he talks about, the other ones have a little bit more political, but he had five of them. And one had to do with education. So, sure, population control, in answer to what you said, population control is definitely a big part of it. Because, and that's what Norman Borlaug had said, that won the Nobel Peace Prize when he developed these wheats, the Green Revolution. He said, we're just buying time. We're just buying some time. We aren't, this doesn't solve
but
the problem.
It's almost political suicide, though, to start talking about population control, isn't it?
Well, that could be changing, too, though.
Well, I hope so.
See, what Gore talks about is in these kind of countries, you need the women have to be empowered in these countries. And as women are empowered in their rights and opportunities, the population might taper off as quickly that way. If you combine that with birth control and a lot of other things, this could happen. And so that seems to make sense to me that when he's talking that. Okay, climate. This is this Global 2000 report. I hate to paint all this bad picture here because we're going to have to quit in about 10 minutes. I'm going to jump ahead. But air quality, we've heard about this. Sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, carbon monoxide. These in the air in many places, World Health Organization, these are exceeding the safe levels. And acid rain, rainfall pH is dropping from 5.7 to less than about 4.5. This and pH, the measure of soil acidity or acidity, this is a logarithmic number. So when you say it goes from 5.7 to 4.5, it isn't just one unit. It's a logarithmic progression. In other words, it's increasing by a factor of 10 all the time.
carbon dioxide increase, 15% in the last century, and so on and so forth. Ozone, you've heard about all those. So those things are real. And Vice President Gore in his book talks about those types of things as well. Now, this is not necessarily agriculture, but agriculture uses quite a bit of energy. Let's just look at this. This is what's happened. You know the figures. 1900, 1977, look at the population, look at the energy demand. This stops at 1977, and I don't suppose it hasn't tapered off. In other words, just a lot more energy being used by the people that we have. Per capita energy consumption. Look at the developing nations versus the developed. So we're over here from 60 to 1976. It went up. Developed nations, they had a lot less to do it, they went up too. So as countries develop, they're going to maybe use more energy. So that, you know, the whole total thing about how are you going to supply this energy. This one is just a split of where does the energy come from. I won't spend any time on that. But what I want to show you, and this is, of course, what is the future energy world going to be consisting of? And in this, back 15, 20 years ago, they were saying that in the year 2020, we're going to have to get that much more out from nuclear energy. Whereas here in 1977, you had this much, it increased. Now, in this book that's just been written, nuclear energy apparently can never take up, I think he said more, maybe about 18%. So that pie maybe was, when he wrote this, they cut that pie too big, nuclear energy. So you got all these other things around here that we're going to have to get our energy, plus some new ones now that I don't have time to go into. So that's some real challenges. Real challenges.
Why are they getting gradually larger?
That's a total. That represents the total amount that was used.
More
a bigger pie. Okay, the pie's just got to be bigger.
It's not just divided differently, it's also more.
That's right. Yep. And as the population goes up, it's just going to be a bigger pie unless everybody starts. In other words, the populations around the world is going to grow so greatly that even though everybody cuts back, it's still going to take more energy.
As the food shortages appear and the population increases, when do you feel the like the United States and some of the European countries really start protecting their borders from the immigration people that I mean, what you're seeing right now is I was reading an article in the New York Times about the Chinese trying to get into New York and the ship grounded, and I mean it's a big problem, you know, all over the United States as far as immigrants trying to get in here.
Well, I know that the thinking, at least in the book that's written by Senator Gore here, he said that as you move ahead, what you've got to think about is sort of open borders. So that, see, that would be, in other words, if we're going to have a truly global village,
right,
mentality and actuality in the long run, you can't exclude people and trade back and forth. So it's going to be a lot of tough sledding. You know, about who sells who to what to who and when and for profit and so on and so forth. A lot of those questions have to be worked out. Now, I think we're just going to have time to just show you a couple slides. And that has to do, because this has to do with energy. This is a calculation that been made by a person at Cornell. It's widely quoted, the first time he published it in Science. What he did is he calculated it out. The digestible energy output, in other words, what do you get out of, let's see here, in this case, corn grain. What we get out of corn grain is energy we can use, whether you feed it to pigs or whether we make corn flakes out of it. Okay, we get something out of it, energy. And what is the fossil energy that you put in? In other words, how much fossil energy are you putting in to get that out? Okay, they calculated this all out, including the energy it costs to make the machines and everything else. Okay, when you do that, corn grain comes out of 2.5 megacalories to megacalories. In other words, you put in, you get 2.5 out for every unit of the fossil energy you're putting in. Soybean, 2. Corn silage, 4.1. Hay, none of these we eat directly. Grass silage, 8.2. This is the area I work with. But corn, grain, soybean, these are grains. area, and this is a legume. And when you go down here and you take pasture, for example, these deer, for example, that are out here munching on the grass and walking around, and I don't know what the hunting season is out here. Next fall, if somebody go out and you can hunt, you can shoot one of those deer. The deer, the energy that deer is using of fossil energy in relation to what it produces, so to speak, is very high. Okay? So what it's telling us that in the particular area that I worked with was that if we're looking for efficiency, if we're looking for efficiency of our fossil energy that we have and putting it into agriculture, you can't just go with necessarily corn and grain. And the thing that galls me is when you take corn grain that you synthesize nitrogen from natural gas and you to make nitrogen and you put it on a corn crop, and then we take the corn and we make ethanol out of it, or gas oil, it's not efficient. And yet we're doing it. We're going to be doing it more and more. So here's a case of a government policy that's driving something that's not necessary. There's a professor at Iowa State, a chemical engineer, has calculated that out, and he's about as popular. Just he's about as popular as that guy that said Walmart doesn't do the community any good. You know, I mean, you know, he's kind of against the stream, and he says that growing corn grain to make gasoline out of it, it just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense right now. See, but you don't hear that. See, we don't hear that. And so I think we have to ask.
In Iowa, anyhow.
Pardon?
You don't want to say.
Well, the Iowa corn growers, our corn producers, have a very they have a different viewpoint. Yes.
Why was rice and wheat left off?
Well, this is just as comparison to tea. I pulled off the ones that I worked with these crops, and so I just for purposes. Now, one last thing I want to show you because it has to do, and I think it's more of a bright spot from what we've been talking about. We have to go up ahead. This just shows, I don't want to show you that one. I better go on. That's not in this country, that's someplace else. Okay, let me just show you this because it has to do with land use. This is Western Iowa again. And these rolling hills they wanted to grow corn on. So back 30, 40 years ago, they made terraces here. See these terraces? And they have grass seeded on them. And the terrace would go around like this, they're on the hill back here. And then there'll be another terrace that comes in and goes around here. And so if you come in here, you could plant corn in there. You wouldn't have the erosion going from the top of the hill down. Okay, that's so you could grow corn. Well, it turns out now that that's not economic. Those aren't big enough patches to grow corn on with the mechanization we have. So now this land goes back into grass and legumes that it should have been in the first place. So the mistake of 25, 30 years ago, well, it wasn't a mistake then, it was viewed as a, in other words, the vision that we have sometimes is not maybe great enough. So now they say that they could have avoided that expense. One little terrace around top of that hill and put it in grass and graze it, that would have been the best way to use that land. So it's constantly changing. I think I will show you this one. Now, in this drive in Western Iowa to grow corn, the Soil Conservation Service has come up with another scheme. Remember, and this is what they call a bench terrace. In other words, you take the land and you level it out and drop it down. Paul, you'd like that with a machine. See, then you go in here and you plant this terrace, 8 rows of corn going this way, and then this is just an experiment. Then you come 8 rows back and it's level. And then it drops down and then you get another bench terrace. And when you saw, if you see pictures of Southeast Asia, where there's been tremendous dense population for centuries, they have bench terraces. So, who knows, you know, whether this is a trend that will continue or not. I suppose it all depends upon the economics.